Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, after Spot of Geek News, we're speaking with attorney Michael Mount about the reason and rationale for copyright, its history, and what's happening currently, the current state of copyright with the digital age upon us. During the second half of the show, welcome to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And if I'm speaking too fast for you, don't worry. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. I'm talking too fast for myself, even. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, the technical trainer for Surf Control. Hey, Miles.
Hiya.
Sean Cleveland, senior PR marketing manager for NetCell. Sean, hey.
Good morning, Lyle.
And, of course, we also have Michael Mount, the attorney, about copyright in the air room. And, Michael, if you'd like to speak with us during our news segment, please do so. We always like another fresh voice joining us. So, Michael, thanks for being here. Good morning.
Pleasure.
And before we get on our topic of copyright and the status of it, let's get into some geek news. And, Miles, because you're looking at me, I'm going to look at you. And what you got, sir?
A Colorado firm called American Environmental Products has developed a glow-in-the-dark lamp. Think of your standard fluorescent bulb, but putting glow-in-the-dark material inside of that bulb so that when the bulb goes out, it still glows. Now, some folks want lights out, that would be fine, but what about things... it really helps out with industrial areas where you don't want the lights to go out if there's a power outage. Also in homes, in certain areas where you just don't... The light is always on, but then if the power goes out, there'll still be a light there. And because the material is inside the bulb itself, it means that when the power is out, you could take the bulb out of the fixture, and for going on about an hour, you'd be able to use it as light to navigate around instead of trying to fumble around, trying to light candles.
Because when the darkness is out and you have low light, it's nice to carry a long glass tube with you. Well,
I see the purpose around trying to find fire.
Yeah. I see the purpose of it. That makes a lot of sense. It doesn't seem like a real innovation, but I guess to some degree, if you use it for that
but
purpose,
no one's done it yet.
Well, then it's an innovation, I think,
right,
by definition.
But they're also talking about in terms of areas that were sensitive, that someone couldn't just come in and with a hammer and knock out the bulb, because even if the bulb was shattered, then it's still going to have that glow. There's still going to be
light. And then the person knocks it out will have it glowing all over the place. Delicious. So it sounds like a really good purpose. Do they have them in the little tiny round fluorescent bulbs as well, or if they're not?
I believe it's in their first steps. They've just been demonstrating it. It will be more expensive. They were looking at somewhere
really?
Around. Well, they're looking at about five times as expensive as
right.
a typical bulb.
But it does make sense because, I mean, in most industrial environments, people have emergency backup systems with batteries, and once the power is tripped, it will work for 6 hours with lights coming back on.
Mm-hmm.
So that of course, is a pretty expensive solution, but it's required when you have a certain amount of people in a building.
Right.
I wonder if the people that do the – probably OSHA does the regulations on that, if they would start accepting these bulbs as a replacement for that purpose.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, this is also for the home user as well,
right.
just to have something there. And
because everyone has fluorescent tubes in their house.
And it, presumably with economy of scale, they wouldn't be as that much more expensive. They'd just be another brand of
I can see it taking off on a marketing perspective where everybody has to have everyone above their bulbs like that, and you can never be in darkness. Turn off your lights. I tried, Mom.
I can't sleep.
My house is too bright. Thank you, Miles, for that. Sean, hi. You look so serious. Welcome to Geek Speak.
I do.
You do? Well, you were looking at me like, come on, talk about this some other time.
No, I think I just need to pound more coffee.
Yeah,
maybe
okay.
That's it, huh? Get me going.
So it's a sleep, not serious.
Yeah, it's more like
I was getting confused.
Where am I again?
Yeah, addict.
You're listening to Geek Speak, and you're on Geek Speak, Sean. What's up?
So this is kind of interesting. Apple's so-called brilliant idea, this is the way the Inquirer.net put it. Great site if you just like, the gossip. I guess they had this idea of publishing audio broadcasts over the Internet.
Wow, how original.
It's called podcasting.
what are you talking
about? AMD thought that they could patent the idea.
AMD did?
Or excuse me, Apple.
Apple
thought they could patent the idea of podcasting. Go great with iTunes and iPods, that sort of thing. Well, according to the U.S. Patent Office, a guy named John Platt, senior researcher for the Knowledge Tools Group at Microsoft, already did that. He patented an application to generate playlists for a library collection of media items via selecting a plurality of seed items, at least one which is an undesirable seed item. You probably understand.
In other words, a jukebox, and they put it on a computer.
So, that's kind of probably more than we need to know. But the bottom line is Apple's U.S. Patent Office,
said no to Apple because somebody
did. Their claim was rejected, and now they're going to go fight the evil empire because Apple's right and Microsoft is wrong, right?
Let them duke it out.
Yeah. So that's interesting. We'll see where that goes.
All right, Miles, back to you.
Oh, sure. No, I'm not ready.
No, that's right. If you're not looking at me, don't talk to you, right? Okay, go on.
There's a big concern about the change in daylight savings time with regards to electrical equipment.
Oh, okay.
Have you heard about the change? There's been a proposed change.
Oh, there's a proposed change to the way we do it. Okay.
Actually, it's an energy bill that I believe was signed by the president on August 8th.
Okay.
Extending the time of daylight savings time. Daylight savings time starts earlier, ends later.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of devices such as VCRs, cell phones, watches that are working on that old model.
Right.
And now
they do it automatically, but they will do it wrong.
Right. But then there may also be other devices that are a little bit more critical than making sure you record your favorite television show. So there's a question of all these electronic devices, kind of like Y2K in the small, where there'll be an hour off when people aren't expecting it.
Do you think that's ever really that much of an issue?
Daylight savings time?
No, I mean,
ask anybody who gets up in the morning.
No.
Has to get up
okay,
an hour
so
earlier.
the first day, everybody's late for work. I mean, we're not talking about like, water won't be turned off at the right time, so dams will break. I mean, we're not talking about like crops of that nature.
What we're talking about are thousands of TiVo users missing their shows.
so the political ramifications could be
right. But then again, you're going to have companies that are going to have to roll out fixes for all of the operating systems for every computer that they have, and spending the IT time.
Not that they will. People will just have computers.
Actually, there's talk that utilities users might get a free hour of utilities because of this.
Beautiful.
Unless it's fixed.
So. Yeah, so everybody turn on their air conditioner at the same time.
All right. Well, keep us abreast of that. I'm interested in whether it's going to be a big.
Oh,
problem.
Now you're interested. Now you're
just because it's so funny.
Okay.
Well, it's just an hour, you know. The thing is, every time we do daylight savings, 10% of the population messes up. It just happens, so it's no big deal. And do you ever really trust when your watch changes automatically? I hate that. I want to know.
Because
then you go along your house, you're setting all your little clocks. You're like, oh, look, a battery and your little rotator thing. That's easy. Got a wind up clock. No problem. And then you get to your watch, you're like,
I enjoy the fact that my computer would switch over correctly. I didn't have to think about it.
Your computer's going to do it anyway.
Hey, well, it's going to do it the wrong time.
Oh, whoa, you've got a Dell in front of you. There's no Apple in front of you. What's going on, Miles?
Right, a couple of things. One, my Apple's at home.
Okay.
And two, I dropped my Apple, and now the power connector isn't working correctly.
What is
so now I have no, I have no battery power on it.
That's you have always break laptops, so there's no battery power. But
wait, I always break laptops and there's no battery.
Last laptop I gave you.
No,
you got
no
it
that
broken.
Was after you took it apart.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so let's go on with the show, back to the business. Sean, next news item.
Sure, I can fix that. So, a new master's degree research project at MIT is turning into an actual product that will be available to people. It's called Jerkometer. It's going to be software, it looks like, for PDA. That you hold up to your telephone to find out if people that you're talking to are actually paying attention or if they're really involved in the conversation. So basically it rates speech patterns, it analyzes speech patterns and voice tones to rate people on a scale of 0 to 100% on how engaged they are in a conversation.
Oh, I can just hear the sound of a million marriages falling apart as we speak.
You're only listening to 75%. What's going on?
Can you imagine your mother getting a hold of this? You never listen to me. Now I can prove it.
We should have it on the show so we can find out if we're listening to each other. a PDA that can do A PDA that can do voice, like pattern recognition, like understand. What,
yeah,
like,
well,
this is like a lot of code.
This is technology using mathematical algorithms that test stress and empathy in a person's voice, and there are lots of papers written on this. It's nothing new. It's just this implementation of taking that data. It's very new.
So now I'm thinking that's them's fighting words to say that emotions are based upon a mathematical equation.
I like it. So, Sean,
So when you pull this up, it could tell you, I mean, like, actually say, this person is acting like a jerk. Do you want to hang up? Or it could say, wow, you're
a phone.
It could rate your voice. You're a smooth talker. You're doing great. I think what they're looking at using it in places like focus groups, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, to see just how well that this information they're getting. Just, you know, if people are just saying whatever they want to get the money, or if they actually have something to say. I don't know. Should be interesting, though.
You know, it seems interesting that you have to have a small electronic device to determine if the person's talking to you effectively. You think that, I don't know, we could figure that out with our ears. But thanks, Sean. Miles, want to do one more?
Sure. This actually, I think, would be a nice segue into our general conversation.
Well, okay, then hang on a second. Sean, do you want any more today?
Yeah, actually, okay. Remember that whole upgrade ban that Microsoft imposed? The Windows Genuine Advantage, where they check your serial number?
Yeah, that just happened.
Yeah, if it's not correct, then you don't get upgrades.
Yeah.
Except for security upgrades. They were still going to allow anybody, even people with, you know, compromised versions of Windows. Okay, so illegal versions of Windows. To upgrade, to get their security updates. But if you wanted to get anything, other updates at all regarding the software, you're out of luck.
Well, but they did a really great program where they said, you know, do you think you have a legal program? Because
yeah,
we know that
and then,
so you get a cheaper upgrade kind of thing. That was kind of
depending
nice
on who you were.
Right.
Yeah. Well, they seem to be abandoning that.
Really? Why? Was it too much tech support problems?
They just can't keep up with the hackers. Every time they tried to patch it, hackers turn around and figure out a way to get past it again.
It's a shame because Microsoft might go to business with this.
It sounds like they're going to keep it in place. They realize that hackers are going to get around it, so they're just not going to waste any more time on it. So those people who, you know, who don't know anything about hacking, they might still see that and say,
Which is nice, because that was one of the big stances that Microsoft had, was that we don't know when people have legal copies or not. You might have an illegal copy if you got an OEM product, and it just got installed, and it was wrong.
Right.
So, and that's not uncommon when you buy, like, a cheap computer from a small store. You know,
right.
Something like that could have happened.
So the bottom line is, hackers and pirates get Windows for free. The rest of us have to pay for it.
So what does that say? If hackers
I don't
want to
pay
the,
for it.
Yeah, if hackers can get into the update site, what does that say about their security model in general?
I don't want to talk about that.
I'm sorry.
Okay, back to your topic, Miles. Last news story before we get on to it.
Yes, a gentleman named Jose Avila, a person that's an interior designer,
mm-hmm.
Was basically decided, I'm going to create all of my furniture out of used FedEx boxes.
Right.
And so he made a bed out of it, a couch, some chairs, a table, computer work desk, and then just posted pictures of it up on the site. He wasn't selling anything. He just had a picture of his apartment. In general, you could probably say that he was selling it as, hey, look how creative I am.
Right.
But didn't look like he was trying to sell actual FedEx furniture. Well, FedEx took umbrage at this behavior.
And their trademark being or their logo being everywhere.
Right. And they were suing him on trademark, but what was curious about it was they were also trying to sue him on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, using copyright law.
Wait.
For it.
Why?
Because a website was involved. It was
right.
And then also talking about, well, he had this website, and because it was named .com, well, it's obvious he was going to sell it.
Oh. Right, because that's what .com infers.
As opposed to using .net, yeah.
Yeah, because I have sites that make sense that they're .coms because I'm selling things, like my name, Troxel.com. I'm actually telling my child, if you're interested. No,
yeah,
I mean,
you're for sale.
Yeah,
we already know that you're
for sale. There's pictures of me on a .com site, oh no.
But it's been a big problem where people are saying, okay, we can see the trademark issue because you have FedEx on there. We're not, you know, FedEx is not endorsing his activities, quite the contrary. But where does copyright come into play?
Interesting. Well, maybe we'll get to that pretty soon. We're living in the age of information, and, of course, with the age of a lot of creation of information and creativity, concerns of ownership and equitability come into play. And Michael Mount is here, an attorney focusing on digital copyrights. And Michael joins us today to give us a what's what in the current state of U.S. copyright and where it's going. Michael Mount, thank you for coming to GeekSpeak, and welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Let me make sure your mic is high enough. That seemed a little... Here, let's see. There you go. Okay, let's try it again. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, there you go. That nice, deep, beautiful voice. All right, let's start off with a quick rundown history, if you will, of copyright. Please tell us, why do we have copyright in the United States of America?
Actually, it's very important to know a little bit about how it started, because the same principles are the principles we're fighting over today in terms of a tension between the rights of the creator and an obligation to the public to use things that are, have been created and can be useful to them. And it goes back, like most of our law, to England. And even the ideas of natural right and personal property come from England. In about 1710, it was codified in the Statute of Anne. And in this three-paragraph piece, it gives the essentials, which are still applicable today, which says that a creator deserves to benefit from his creation. It would not be here without it. And I think they allotted 14 years at that time. But at the same time, in order to prevent a creator from withholding something from the public forever, they said there was a public policy that something that is useful to the public should be finally made generally available to the public without without hindrance, mm-hmm. after some time frame. And these are exactly the same tensions that are coming today. That idea was developed through the common law system in England, which is, you know, courts modify the codification of the laws and develop it as cases come before them, and they see how the code is actually lived out.
Mm-hmm.
It came to America, as we took most English law when it was developed. We finally, I think we entered into some very primitive copyright law in the late 18th century, early 19th century. It was the first real full-blown copyright law came in 1909, the 1909 Act, and it had a lot of restrictions on it, a lot of formalities. In order to get your copyright as a creator, you had to register it with the government, and you also had to put a copyright notice on it, and it had to be in a particular form, and it was. And then you had
to
renew
that little
it.
Copyright symbol.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You had to renew it after 28 years for another, and if you could only renew it in the last year. And so there was a lot of bureaucratic problems with it.
What was the renewing after 28 years? Why did they want that to be in place?
It was originally developed so that if someone purchased a license to use that copyright, a large company, that it would be able to revert to the original author so that he wouldn't lose it forever. Say it became developed and it was worth something, so that he and first line of descendants could actually benefit from it. So it was a very humane
So does that mean when you say reverts, after 28 years, then it would revert to the original owner?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For the duration of whatever the government felt.
It could. I mean, he could re-license it.
He could re-license it.
Okay. Go on. But the rest of the world was moving someplace else. They were moving away from formalities. They were moving to make it easier for the creator to retain his copyright and not lose it because of some scheduling problem or something was, mm-hmm. overlooked. And of course the United States was not of course but the United States was slow to adopt this. Most of it came under what was finally called the Berne Convention, which most countries in the world belong to today. And finally, with the next revision of the Copyright Act in 1976, America adopted most of the Berne Convention outlines and ways of working.
What are examples of the Berne Convention that the U.S. didn't do it before that?
Well, it was the still maintaining the need to register.
Okay.
Still maintaining the need to put a copyright notice on, and if it didn't meet the formalities of place and form, you could lose your copyright. The benefits going forward, one of the main benefits was that if a foreign creator published a work in, say, France, and then it was republished in the United States, and he had a problem, we would treat that foreign creator
as
the
copyright
same
holder.
We would,
right.
One of our own residents, and that was fundamental.
Right.
Copyright notice was done away with, although it's still recommended for certain notice purposes. I think it's required in two kind of havens for Nazis in South America, which is, you know, I mean, just these two remote jurisdictions.
Okay.
But also, then the registration went away. We have retained one part of the registration, which is that in order to bring litigation, you must register.
Uh-huh.
And a good benefit, and the reason why with my clients I encourage them to register, is one is evidentiary.
Right.
You deposit a copy of your material with the U.S. government, and they've got it.
And does that go into the Congress, the Library of Congress?
You also, there's a depository requirement where you send two copies to the to Congress, the Library of Congress. And that goes back to the Statute of Anne. You had to produce, 10 copies for them to have. Again, the same public policy.
The idea now that if you think it's worth enough, the society in general think it's worth enough to keep a hold of it and hold on to it in case you lose it or whatever purpose.
What if we should have it and have access to it?
You mentioned that basically there was two kind of concepts with copyright. One is that a person owns it, and then later it goes into a public space so that other people can use it, and that's kind of like that's what the rules and regs about that are what's being argued. It all comes back down to those two things, really. So about the ownership thing, I mean, the duration seems like something that really changes quite a bit, and we'll talk a little bit more about other things that cause the duration to change. But let's talk about the ownership thing. What about if I hire Miles to make something for me, and I've paid for his time? Who owns that, me or him?
Well, it's that goes to the work for hire doctrine,
right,
which is a much misunderstood doctrine. If he's an employee of yours, and he, within the scope of his employment, you hire him as a programmer, and he makes code for you, you own it. In fact, you are the author in terms of the Copyright Act. If he is an outside contractor, if he produces something for you within, I think it's only like 8 enumerated categories, then it has to do with like a forward to a book. It would be a map. I mean, they're really inconsequential kinds of supplemental work. Then you would own it. But primarily, if he's an outside contractor, in order for you to own it, he has to assign it to you expressly in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I can't tell you how many software companies there are out there who don't own their code, or more likely, they don't own their documentation.
Uh-huh.
Because they put it outside. And what we find is that when people, in the pirated world, when people steal code, they almost steal the documentation and reproduce it verbatim. So in the courts, a lot of the evidence that comes in to prove infringement is production of the documentation.
The documentation is funny. As a programmer, that's probably the hardest part of the job.
And when you were talking about outside contractor having to assign the rights to the company, for an employee, that's done just when the employee is hired. The employee signs that document saying everything that I do is...
He doesn't need to do that. That's kind of a backup. He doesn't need to do that. If he is an employee, hired to be, work in the kitchen, and at night he goes home and makes code, that's not the company's code. If he takes company research home and a company laptop home and makes it, then you're going to have a different story.
And this is some of the issues that have to be that have in the courts, like. For example, laptops are very common. Right now, Miles and I are both, and Sean, I think, are all using laptops that are owned by the companies we work for. And we use them for general purpose because it's kind of like it's a thing that's used, it's so useful. But I'm definitely conscious of what is on the machine and what is mine versus what the company's. And that's a difficult thing. And I would assume that if I did something and I was using company resources at all, whether it be at night or not, potentially the company could own it.
Potentially. Yeah.
So,
there's
of course, they're going to have deeper
kind of a
pockets.
Of things that they compare. And one of the points about copyright is that when it does enter the courts, it's very rarely a slam dunk issue. It is almost always a case by case analysis.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a little break, but we're going to stay with the topic today because it's so fun, and we probably won't be doing calls right away. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Second Harvest Food Bank will hold their annual Santa Cruz Chef's Dinner to raise money for the fight against hunger on Thursday, September 22nd at Holy Cross Hall. Information is available at 722-7110, extension 228.
KUSB co-sponsors Chairs for Change Youth Art Show and Auction, presented by Youth Services of Santa Cruz County. This event will auction 14 one-of-a-kind art chairs that are the expression of the artist's hopes, dreams, fears, and nightmares. Most of the youth involved in this event are high-risk kids who have found their way into recovery from substance abuse. This event will take place on Friday, August 19th at 7 p.m. in the gardens of Aladdin University on Freedom Boulevard in Watsonville. For more information, please call 728-2227.
This week on This American Life, feel the suspense. live the danger.
Out of all the pursuits that we have covered, we have never seen anything like this.
The world's slowest car chase. No cops in pursuit, televised live for 4 hours.
The suspect still driving well within the speed limit. In fact, slower than the speed limit.
Stories of fate and the people who run from it without breaking any traffic laws this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruzeo, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruzeo membership is available online at cruzeo.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're speaking to attorney Michael Mount about copyright, and it's been a great topic so far, and we're not going to go over to phone calls unless you've got a dying question for our guest about copyright. And if so, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can use the internet, click on geekspeak.org, and then click on Contact Us. All right. We were just talking about the history, but now let's flip back, or let's go forward a little bit and talk about something more current, like Grokster versus the MGM. And let me turn your microphone on so you can actually respond to my query.
Grokster's probably the most important case, certainly that happened in the last year, and maybe with Napster and the real case probably during the last 10 years at least.
Now, compared to Napster, can you speak to Napster? But it was kind of a slam dunk. Napster had copyright material. They were pushing it out, helping people to get it.
Right. Well, it's a slam dunk in retrospect.
In retrospect.
But it was amazing how many people did not think that they would ever go down on infringement. The problem with Napster, the way Napster operated, is that it has central servers and on this peer-to-peer network. So if you wanted to download stuff, you went through their central server. They also had a problem that in their investment literature, they said the purpose of the business was to facilitate pirating of copyright-protected work. I don't know who was advising them legally, but it was probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
And
we want to help people break the law.
That's right.
Isn't a good business practice.
So they certainly were culpable for infringement, and for facilitating infringement among their people.
Now, Grokster kind of plays on Napster as in a name in general. So right. I've never used Grokster. I don't really know it. So can you give us a little what was their business practice?
What Grokster did was they thought, well, you know, the problem with Napster was they had a central server. So we'll circumvent that. What we'll do is we'll have, you know, real, as close to peer-to-peer that we can possibly get. What we're going to do is we're going to provide people with free software by which they can talk to each other and trade files. And we won't know whether those files are stolen or not.
Right.
And we will feed advertising to these people, and we'll make our money off the advertising, not off the sale of software even. We're giving it for free. And a court in San Diego agreed with them, federal court. The much besotten Ninth Circuit agreed with them, and it went up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, and hang on just a second. When you say they agreed with them, a lawsuit came out from somebody?
That's right. MGM and four or five, maybe 15 other record companies, came after them.
Now, why did the Ninth Circuit say no, just because they weren't doing it themselves?
They misinterpreted a previous case, which
turns out they misinterpreted because
turns out, right, which was the Sony Betamax case, which is probably the seminal case in the last century on copyright. And the Sony Betamax case came about when VCRs first came out, and you could record off the air. And the court said they took a piece of law from patent law, which said that if you are selling a device that is a staple a device of commerce, something that's used a lot, and it has substantial non-infringing use, like playing home videos that you use or videos that you buy from the store, although the home market wasn't really developed at that time. And also then if you happen to tape a show off the air, it's not for commercial purposes. It's for personal use. It's really what they called time shifting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that case was much criticized, but the fact is it solved a real public problem.
Well, who won that case?
Sony did.
Sony won it and saying you can time shift your stuff for personal.
That's right.
Now, why then did the Audio Home Recording Act or the come into play? How'd that fit into that?
Once again, it's the same way fair use, the same way much of the law happens, is under common law, the courts kind of evolve and continue to see cases, individual events, and rule on them. And slowly what happens is you get a very stable body of law, and it's not going to move much. You really understand it. At that point, the Congress says, let's codify it. Because we don't want it to change. We don't want a strange court to do anything. We really want to make this into the law.
And then you're not, when something like that happens, it's kind of like it's been proven through the courts that it should fit that way, and therefore Congress can pass it relatively easily because there's not a lot of controversy on how it should work.
Correct.
And then, so that just kind of made sure that, yeah, that is a reality. You can have personal use. And I'm assuming that comes into play quite a bit with Grogster and such. So Grogster basically says, we're doing this to help people do fair or public personal use. That's their stance?
That's right. I mean, the first defense of anybody who's accused of infringement is fair use.
Right.
Another doctrine absolutely, totally misunderstood by most people. And Grogster thought they had escaped because this has a substantial non-infringing use under Sony. Or it's fair use under the Fair Use Doctrine, which was finally codified in the 1976 Act. And the Supreme Court, Judge Souter, who writes most of the copyright-related decisions out of the Supreme Court, and I think this was a unanimous decision. I could be wrong in that, but I think it was a very fast and unanimous decision, said, no, the Ninth Circuit got it totally wrong again, and it's not fair use, and it certainly is not, doesn't fall under Sony. Sony was very specific about it. What we have here is we have a company that knows what they're doing, even if they don't know the specific, you know, they don't have a specific instance of infringement. They know that they're out there. They've distributed something in order to allow people to circumvent the devices.
So that was the real basis. I mean, what if there was 80% of the sharing happened to be totally legal sharing? Would that court have totally said a different thing with Grogster?
I don't know whether they have a different thing, but it would certainly influence, because then you get, you know, is what is a substantial, in, you know, non-infringing use of the device?
Right.
If it's 80%, it's pretty much out there. It goes a little bit more to what do they really know is happening, and could they influence it? Could they stop it? And are they benefiting financially from it?
And they were benefiting financially.
They were selling advertising, okay, so, and the more infringement there was, the more money they made.
Yeah, I was under the impression also that the Grogster folks were actually saying that, yeah, it's probably doing these things. They had actually publicly made statements to the effect of, this is, you know, sharing your files, your this music.
Right.
That's right.
And they were kind of flaunting that.
They were flaunting it, which I think made them why they went after them. Because
right.
They said, we found a way to get around the Napster decision.
Right.
Why
aren't
we smart?
Right.
No. Right. Which has been different from the recent work with BitTorrent. The creator of BitTorrent, another peer-to-peer system, was talking about. I mean, he has publicly stated that this is not for. I do not support
copyright infringement.
Yeah, or just illegal uses of it, and has been working with the studios for distribution via BitTorrent.
Right. I want to talk about BitTorrent briefly. Do you know much about BitTorrent?
No, I was thinking, but it sounds like it's on along the same lines as iPod and Apple.
Well, in that the creator and some of the people are talking to industries, which is a big reason why Apple succeeded with doing what they did, but we'll talk about in just a second. BitTorrent is this idea that when multiple people want a file and there's only one person that's sharing that file, as the multiple people are downloading the file, that one person has to have all that bandwidth load, which is quite difficult. So the idea is that you split it up into chunks, and as another person downloads it, other people can download from that person. So it's a
small pieces at a time, called swarming.
Right, and it's a better way to share lots of large data. And it's being used effectively in a lot of situations, like releases of software that a lot of people want that's free, like open source operating systems.
Yeah, the Linux kernel is now available through BitTorrent downloads.
Which makes it all of a sudden, you don't have to wait for 4 days when they release a new Linux kernel,
mm-hmm.
which is nice. And for podcasts and for media sharing of free content like we podcast, GeekSpeak, and if we wanted to produce the high-level bandwidth one, the high-quality one, we'd do it through BitTorrent. And Miles is working on that diligently. In any case, though, let's go on to what Apple did with the iPod and with iTunes and how it totally changed the big piracy that was happening, which was music.
Well, Let me just address what you just said, which is that there you have substantial non-infringing use. Peer-to-peer, per se, has never, you know, no one's ever looked at it and said, it's a terrible technology, we shouldn't allow this to be done. It said, we're not sure how it's going to play out because the people who are using it now are just stealing copyright-protected works. So this now sounds like something that's very worthwhile, and it'll start to develop the really good uses of peer-to-peer. And what they're doing is exactly what Steve Jobs and Apple did. And this was, it was simple and brilliant, and he solved a lot of these problems. He went to the studios and said, I've got a device that's great, and people are going to love it. You've got the content. What do we have to do to get that content to the people? And the first thing is, we license it. We pay them for their content. They own it. It's their core business. The next thing is, we put in a digital rights management system so that we, you know, affirmatively try and stop pirating. We may not be perfect, but we're not standing back and we're not doing it in name only. We're really moving ahead.
And anyone that does pirate through Apple Source is infringement of the Digital Copyright Act.
That's right.
Which makes it a little easier for coming against, bringing them to suit or something.
That, well, it's not only a financial suit, commercial suit. It is now a jail term.
A jail term. Well, we'll talk about the Digital Millennium Act in a little bit. So go on. So Apple went to the big boys and
that's
said...
That's right. So they licensed the material, they found digital rights management, and they also found the right pricing level. You know, 99 cents, you know, a play. And in the iPod machine, although you had flexibility to copy it to some other limited number of devices, I think it's 3, you really couldn't put it back on your PC and distribute it to 10 million people automatically.
Easily, right.
And this, easily. And this then goes back to the industry's experience with audio tape. You know, after a while, it's just too much in order, you know... The world is not going to do it en masse.
Right, that's the thing, is the audio tape, it didn't kill the industry because when it really came down to it, no one really did that.
It's easier to go buy it.
Right. Yeah. Miles, I'm sure you've got a point here. You're looking at me.
No, yeah. that was actually basically the point. It's saying that if something is, you have a CD that costs $17 and then you want to listen to a song from this CD, song from that CD, paying that much money just for a few songs, people, I'd just as soon get it from... You know, get from online, get a...
Do what people have been doing right. With tapes for a long time.
And yet, at the same time, just being able to go to the iTunes music store, for example, and paying 99 cents for a song, it's easier to do that, it's more convenient than to try to search around and find a file and be worried about viruses and all that.
And this was the kind of marketing research that the industry responds to very well. They said, the long playing album's finally gone. What we really do is we can sell more records if we make it available, on singles.
Mm-hmm. But, say goodbye to the filler song.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a totally interesting aspect that Apple's done, and this whole move is done, is that I listen to old albums, or I'll hear a song from an old album and go, I never liked that song before. Now I love it. It's got this nostalgia. It has this thing built into me, and I really admire it because I haven't overheard it. It wasn't the popular song on the album. So now, will we still have that? And that's kind of an interesting possible cultural loss.
Or theme albums.
Theme albums, that's right, thematic albums.
Yeah.
I think they're still being released, but they're definitely more difficult.
I think of Rick James' song, Super Freak. Mm-hmm. That was a B-side that he just needed to fill up the album. Wasn't expecting it to be the big hit, so who knows? Yeah.
Okay, so Apple does this amazing thing of saying, okay, you got all this content, how do we make it available to everybody through our device? And everybody won in that situation.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, and other people have come back and started doing the same type of thing. There's other stores that are doing that same type of thing. Is it kind of a... The industry only does that, though, when there's some kind of electronic enforcement aspect of it?
I think what you have to see is that the entertainment industry has one asset, and that's their libraries, whether it's film, whether it's music. I mean, music right now, you know, or early on, was the first really viable technology. Film and video was still evolving. But they have one asset, and it's their libraries. It's enormous, and they're not going to release it until they know that it's secure and they're not going to lose it. So there was a lot of talk about the industry being behind the curve, but at the same time, the industry, particularly someone like Universal, strangely enough, who you think kind of stodgy, they had VP levels of people really looking and monitoring the developments of technology and looking how to solve the problem. But there was a perception that we had culture clash here.
Yeah.
And that's what Steve did. He broke out of that and went to them. They trusted him because of Pixar, and they said, okay, let's do it.
All right. So that's the iPod. Let's go forward a little bit let's talk about international, what's going on with international. And then I do want to step back, hopefully, towards the end of the and talk about how durations of copyright have come kind of become infinite, and how I don't like that. But what's going on with, like, the EU? I mean, I'm sure that things are happening differently now.
The EU has been following developments in the U.S., particularly Germany. Germany enacted a Digital Millennium Copyright Act spinoff, almost verbatim. I've seen it in translation, and it's almost verbatim, and are enforcing it with vigor. I think they released it on a Friday, and on Monday they had a suit in the courts. So the EU has been very aggressive about this.
Well, if the EU is looking at our Digital Millennium Copyright Act as a model in copying, let's talk about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. What does it do? What is it basically? What are some of the? I mean, I know it does a lot. It's kind of a big act,
right.
But it definitely changed copyright, or it brought in some issues of the new type of copyright issues that we run into, like easy distribution and things of that nature.
Correct.
So what's going on with the Digital Copyright Act?
Well, I think that one of the things that's also misunderstood about the DMCA is that people see it as this big wall that was put up. And what's interesting about it is that the Copyright Office, which is, I think, one of the most functional and sophisticated intellectually offices in the government, really followed the development of technology carefully. They didn't want to move until they really had an idea of where it was going. But they knew that technology moves very quickly. So what they did and what Congress did is they put some limits on it. We're going to try this out.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the provisions were only 2 years long, and then they would be reviewed. And if they worked, they would be extended. They could be amended. And what it really looked at was trying to stop the circumvention of digital management rights devices.
Now, that's a new way of looking at things, because traditionally there was never this idea that, well, if you own a certain type of quills in your home and you did certain things with them, copying a book was more illegal than normally copying a book.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what we're talking. If we try to look at a metaphor and an older copyright, when manuscripts were around and people were copying them with pen, it took so long, it was so hard to do, that there wasn't enforcements of buying certain types of ink. You can't buy the type of ink, only some people can buy it. And now we're kind of seeing that new way of looking at copyright enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally, it seems to me, I have a little bit of a problem with it in some aspects of it. It could be used. For example, I buy a piece of hardware and I take it home and I open it up. Right there, I could potentially be infringing. Or I start working on the hardware in it to bypass some of the security that they have in there because I want to modify it for that purpose, not
mm-hmm.
redistributing it or anything. I am infringing on the Digital Rights Copyright Act, is from what I understand.
In practicality, you have to also understand that the DMCA has not been tested in court very much,
uh-huh.
which is where, and they're looking at these refinements because that's not their intent
mm-hmm.
at all. What their intent to do is have the guy who makes a little black box and sells it. Because, and why it was necessary now, and you haven't seen it before, is that suddenly through digital copies, you have the ability to distribute a perfect copy to unlimited sources in a second.
Right.
And that never happened before. So how do we approach controlling this? And it was digital rights management. Even though it's imperfect, we put it in place. People will crack it. So they said, okay, we're not talking about the public. We're not talking about inadvertent infringement. We're talking about people who really have the technical sophistication and the intent to go in and circumvent those devices for the purpose of redistribution.
Mm-hmm. Miles, you got anything on this?
No, I don't.
No, okay.
Lost in thought.
So that's one of the things that happened in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Anything else that really made sense? Any more rights that we got from it?
We got one major right from it, which was, and I'm not sure we got it, the record industry got it, which was they added one more exclusive right to the litany of rights that come in under the Copyright Act, which, for years have been you have the right to make copies. And if you own the creative material, whether you created it, whether you purchased it, or exclusively licensed it, or not exclusively licensed, you have the ability to copy it, you have the ability to amend it, to make derivative works of it, you have the ability to distribute it, you have the ability to publicly perform it or publicly display it. With the DMCA, you now had a right to perform digital copies of sound recordings. And the person who owns sound recordings, of course, is the record industry. For years, when you play music on the radio, the writers got a piece of it, but the record company didn't. It was strictly promotional. And the whole evolution of radio music came under that idea. and evolved and was structured according to.
So now they get a percentage of things that are played on radio?
Right, and it becomes under a statutory royalty, so that it's not a necessarily a negotiated fee. It's a so many cents per copy or per play, not necessarily quite different from the music societies, BMI, ASCAP, C-SCAN.
Which is how artists get money back from airplay.
Correct.
Sean?
What about live performances? Are they still in the public sector?
No, live performances are not. There's a law that says if you have a live performance in your venue, the person who owns the venue must pay the royalties. You do is you sign a contract with ASCAP BMI, and interesting enough, those societies have been trying to enforce it much more aggressively, and they've been trying to enforce it in specific sectors, Latin and Latino music centers,
or
so
this
Mexican
is all new
restaurants
music.
They go after.
In this situation when you have a band goes in and plays cover songs,
right.
Who gets money and how do they deal with that? The band gets paid for being there, and then money goes to ASCAP and BMI,
right.
So that potentially the artist would get paid that originally made the songs or wrote the songs.
But this is only since
from a sampling.
This is only since the act was enabled. Any music before that, is that still in the public sector, or does this go back and... Because from what I understand, live performances...
I think you're talking about duration of copyright, what becomes the public domain. Let's go into that now. I can still perform Mozart if I do it myself, because it's a public thing.
Right.
Where is the line drawn where I can play songs? Can I play Beatles songs because they're more than 30 years old or not?
Not without... Paying for it. Yeah, but again, if they're 30 years old, right, in the Beatles are a great example because they are right in the turning point between the 1909 Act, which changed in the 1976 Act, even though it really wasn't instituted until January 1, 1978. But they also then it dramatically changed. You could lose your copyright prior to that if you didn't follow the formalities. After that, you couldn't. It was there. You didn't have to do anything.
Now, I personally don't have a problem at all with an individual artist never losing their copyright. But when we're talking about work for hire, Disney's a great example of this. Mickey Mouse has been around for, almost 100 years now.
Steamboat Willie.
Steamboat Willie was originally the character. But Mickey Mouse, throughout my lifetime and my children's lifetimes, will not be public. They'll be illegal to reproduce it. Walt, who drew it originally, he's long past gone. Mm-hmm. And that feels that like it violates that idea that the public has ownership of something valuable after a period of time. So how do you address that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. When people say, well, how long is copyright law? And if I don't remember, right off the top of my head, I always say, the life and the existence of Mickey Mouse plus 50 years. So, because if you remember, the Statute of Anne in 1710, it was 14 years. And since then, it's continually, been under 1909, it was potentially 72 years or 48 years. And what you've had a continual expansion. I think it was the Sonny Bono Act, in fact, which finally moved this last duration up. And it was in response from lobbying by Disney.
But didn't just raise the amount of time by 20 years retroactively. That's something that some people don't necessarily know, that the existing copyrighted works retroactively were, their lengths were extended by 20 years.
That's right. And part of that problem is not to cut off somebody right away. It also worked that way when they instituted the 1976 Act, and you had these works going back to 1964, which were kind of grandfathered in. And it was to make it better. For the artist.
Corporations can potentially last forever. They don't, but there are some large old corporations that exist.
Right.
And if the owner keeps on existing and keeps on renewing, or even not renewing, they don't really have to renew, it'll go on forever. So what happens to that stuff? This music is in these giant libraries. When do they become something that is free and public?
Well, at the moment, the terms are the life of the artist plus the life of the creator plus 70 years. Or if it's a work for hire, then it becomes 70 years from the date of publication, or 95 years from the date of publication, or 120 years from the date of creation, whichever is shorter. Now, that like I said, every time, you know, the mouse comes up for termination, it miraculously gets pushed forward.
Yeah.
I think it's an unresolved issue. I think the next time around, it's really going to be a much more contentiously battled.
Well, it was already battled with the Eldred case, correct, with Lawrence Lessig arguing that. Mm-hmm. And I do have to wonder, just from a personal note, talking about extending copyright and the fact that copyright is supposed to be, or in the Constitution is talked about for limited times, securing for limited times the rights for artists. And how, if the Constitution governs, for example, human societies, or art, in this case, our society of people, then how can it be seen limited when it's longer than the length of a human lifetime?
Part of it is for the family. And the heirs of the artist or the creator to have some benefit from it. Remember when we went back and had that reversion earlier on. It also has to be looked at as going all the way back to, which Lawrence fails to do most of the time. You also have to go, he argues a lot of cases, but they're usually on very shaky copyright ground. Go back to the Statute of Anne, and you go back to what was, you know, natural law is where it originally came from. You create something, you own it. You know, it's your property. It wouldn't be there without you. But also the British hate waste, you know, so that if you don't use it, you'll lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what it was about. There is one theory out there about the term of copyright. I think it's probably going to lose, but it will be taken into consideration, which is that if you have a, primarily a company, but it may be a family, in the case of Cat in the Hat, Dr. Seuss is a good example. If you have an entity that owns copyright material and they are actively exploiting it, they are actively putting it on the market, they're actively developing it, then maybe it should go on for a while they're doing that. If they stop doing that, or if it has great, you know, public value, where they kite the prices, for example, then maybe it should be put into the public domain where somebody else can have a chance to do that. Again, this is a theory. I don't know that it'll win.
But that
by
has
any
to
chance.
Do with a commerce perspective. There's also the idea of this public good that comes of it being open.
Right, but the public good is not just because it's open. The public good is because
it exists.
With an exclusive right, you have the ability to hold it off the market entirely.
Yeah.
So this is a way of saying
you can't do that.
You can't do that.
Which is good. All right. I'll give you an opinion point. What do you think about the current state of copyright? Do you like it? Do you think it's going okay?
I think it's fabulous. I think that we're in the middle of a terrific time. Once again, I said, you know, the fundamentals of copyright continue to work at no matter what new technologies come up. This tension, if you work with it and the new technology, you'll find a way that ultimately is fair. I mean, I think where we're going now to resolve this problem is not necessarily licenses, but it may come. Fair use is a privilege. It's not a right. Copyright is a right. You may have the ability that if you buy a piece of material, you can make copies on all your own personal devices as long as you don't broadcast it down the street.
That's Michael Mount, our guest. He's an attorney working for Sun. He also has private clients in Santa Cruz area. This Geeks This Morning with Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Support for this program comes from Metro Santa Cruz newspaper, including a complete calendar, club grid and dining section, arts writing and criticism. Metro Santa Cruz is available in Santa Cruz County every Wednesday. This program is also supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online tonight and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that next week when David Lawrence is on the show. He owns the GeekSpeak name. He's asked us to read that, and we're going to find out what else he's asked and what he's like next week on GeekSpeak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP.